JSA in the 90s. This episode, Justice Society of America number 4, cover dated July 1991. Hello, and welcome to JSA in the 90s, a podcast dedicated to the Justice Society of America and related characters as published in the 1990s. We are a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. My name is the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, but guess what? I have brought along a buddy. In fact, each episode, I invite a guest host to help me tackle an issue of the JSA. You know, some people have a favorite superhero. My guest today seems to have about 50. From Superman to Captain America, from Daredevil to Captain Marvel Shazam, from Batman to even Red Tornado. Fortunately for us, one of those passions is the Justice Society of America. Folks, please help me welcome Mr. J. David Weider. Welcome back to the JSA Brownstone, Dave. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Good. I'm great. I'm glad to be back being a part of my audio comfort food, which means I won't listen to this episode because I can't stand the sound of my voice.
Ah, see, that is so wrong. It makes me sad when I hear you say that. Because, folks, all right, you guys obviously listen to the show, and you have my incredible appreciation for that. I do think you have bad taste in podcasts. I think you should probably look for something better. Because people like me, when I go looking for podcasts, I go looking for J. David Weider, because he's one of my favorite podcasters. So, and to hear you say you don't enjoy hearing yourself makes me sad. Now, you do. I don't know if you know this or not. This is pretty cool. You, sir, are the very first returning guest to JSA in the 90s. So with it, now this fee JSA presents, you know, has had lots of returning guests over the years, but JSA in the 90s that we started 2 years ago, you're our first returning guest. So congratulations, sir.
Do I get a plaque on the wall?
Or it means you've made terrible life decisions. I don't know which it means, but one
could
of those
both.
Two things. Yeah. Could be both. Could be both.
Speaking of life decisions, we're talking now, but you didn't know, but we've had a conversation recently. You recently came back from Heroes Con, and I had a dream in which I flew out on a plane, which taxied me to your front door early in the morning. I was sitting there when you got up, and you were not as surprised as you should be to see me in your living room.
Okay.
I worry about your security. But yeah, we were going to go from there to Heroes Con. In reality, I'm still stuck in Missouri, but
aww.
I was with you in spirit.
We would have loved to have you at Heroes Con. It would be sort of foolish to come to my town, though, because getting a direct flight from my town is really difficult. So you would have had to take like connection to connection to connection. But either way, would have loved to have you there. You know, we were there with Bill Beer, your partner on the Bat Pod, and so many other people. And hopefully one of these days, you are one of the few podcasters that I'm, you know, buddies with that I haven't met in person. And I hope it happens someday soon, sir.
Once the mystery is gone, though, it's gone.
That's what everyone says after they meet me, so don't worry. Well, folks, before we get too much further with this, we probably do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. This episode of JSA in the 90s is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. Each episode will select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStockTrades library, usually to be tied into this month's JSA issue in some way, shape, or form. So we are here today. We're going to be talking about Hawkman, and this comic was published in the 1990s. So if we're talking about Hawkman of the 90s, I got to go for DC Finest Events, 0 Hour, Part 1 Trade Paperback. It's kind of a ridiculously long name, but these are these DC Finest collections that are great. They're doing these new ones that are about events where they publish all the crossover issues as well. So this thing's got Superman and Flash and Legion and Green Lantern and all issues from all these different books, plus 0 Hour issues 3 and 4. So you've got, and obviously you've got Hawkman stuff in here, right? Because, I mean, Hawkman was a kind of a big deal in 0 Hour and what happened to the character. So we've got writers like Dan Jurgens, Louise Simonson, Doug mentioned more, art by Dan Jurgens, Jerry Ordway, John Bogdanov, Mike Manley, and a whole bunch more. Cover art on this is by Jerry Ordway and Dan Jurgens. Page count's 496 pages. Full color, soft cover, goes for $39.99, but you can get it in stock trades right now for only $23.19, which is a 42% discount. Heck of a steal, and I loved 0 Hour. I don't know about you. Like, I know you're a 90s guy as well. Mm-hmm. Did you love 0 Hour, or did you not?
Loved it. Loved it top to bottom.
Fantastic. That brings a lot of joy to my heart. So awesome. So, sir, I know you always come prepared because you are the bomb diggity. What is your pick for in stock trades?
So, because Hawkman is the river song of justice, because you never know when you're meeting him, I chose the Hawkman Omnibus by Jeff Johns, the 2025 edition.
I took a sip of my drink right as you were saying that, so I couldn't.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I almost spit all over my comic book.
Oh, don't do that. No. But yeah, you never know. I mean, have we done this yet? I don't know. But this is a run that came as close as we may ever get to fixing Hawkman's continuity. And as, on top of that, it's a great read. Jeff Johns, of course, wrote it, but Starman writer James Robinson is in the mix. You have artists like Rags Morales and Don Gleason, and they just tell some phenomenal tales of DC's Winged Warrior. This is normally $100. It can be yours for $60 for a full 40% off.
I've read a fair amount of Hawkman stories over the years, especially in the 90s and things like that, and some of the 80s stuff, and even some of the 60s, and I think this Hawkman series is my favorite. I think this is a great distillation of what Hawkman should be.
Yep, and I don't say it fixes continuity. It's as close. It's like Donna Troy. There are some things you just have to let go.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's kind of what it does. It kind of says like, okay, this is who Hawkman is now. Just don't worry about it. It's kind of
is he a space cop? Is he an Egyptian reincarnated prince? Yes.
Exactly. Check or check all the above. Mm-hmm. So, well, that is a great pick, Dave. And if you haven't read the Hawkman Omnibus by Jeff Johns, all those issues, they're really great. So highly recommend it. So for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Because, you know, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying shows like JSA in the 90s, the best way to show your support is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW Podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. And at certain tiers, you get mentioned on your show of choice. Just like these folks who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. Our thanks to our all-star squadron of supporters, Al the Comics Guy, Alex Osias, Bill Beer. I think you know that guy.
I know that guy.
Bruno Diaz, Chris Mort, Craig Fletcher, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, Extremely Uncanny, George Van Note, Gord Tolton, Jason Keane, Jeffrey Owens, Kitchy Baker, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Matt Ev, Michael Bailey, Michael Crouch, Mike Atchison, Mike Zamkowski, Roger Preeb, Little Russell Burbage, Symbol Pending, Ted Killington, and Tim Price. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcast. All right, so folks, remember, as I always say, this show is about building a community of JSA fans around the show. So find us on social media as JSA Presents. And now, this is normally the part of the show where I ask my guests about their origin with the JSA. However, as we mentioned, since Dave's a returning guest, you can simply go back to the April 2025 episode that was during JS April, where Dave shared his thoughts. So for now, though, we came up with an idea here to chat about something because we do have some sad news to share. Since our previous issue's coverage, when we covered issue number 3, we have lost the writer, Len Straczynski. He did pass away. So very sad to see him go. And, you know, I looked at this series as a whole, and I've kind of hinted at this a little bit, but the more I thought about it, is that I've read a lot of comics from this era, right? And strangely, this particular comic series has sadly lost a significantly higher percentage of creators than most other comics from the same era. I mean, we've lost, as I mentioned, Len Straczynski. You know, very young, we lost Mike Parabek. We lost Tom Lyle. We lost Tom Artis. We lost Brian Augustine. And since we've also lost Frank McLaughlin. And so we thought that we would, not to get too sad and morbid, but we thought, let's name some other comic creators that we lost that were too young and celebrate some of their awesome work. So why don't we maybe go back and forth, do a little round robin or so. So you want to go first?
I do. Thank you. So one person I thought of really strongly was Tim Sale.
Ooh, okay.
Which I know can be surprising since I rage quit covering Daredevil Yellow, but that wasn't for the art. That was for the writing. I'm looking at you, Jeff Loeb. Could have been 4 issues. But Tim Sale, his style, it took a little getting used to, but once you synced up to it, he was an incredible storyteller. He used shapes in ways that mimic maybe animation with more detail, and he just made beautiful art, and he was far, far too young.
Yes, yeah. You know, it's funny you mentioned Daredevil Yellow. I think that may be the only Tim Sale book I've ever read. I've never read The Long Halloween, which is probably a terrible mistake, right?
Depends how you read it, is what I will say.
Okay, interesting. Okay. So, let's do it this way. If you were to tell someone the pinnacle of Tim Sale work that you've read that just brings you joy, what would you tell them to go read?
Superman for All Seasons. It is. It takes a little bit to get used to his Superman because Superman is this big, bulky guy. Mm-hmm. Once you do, you see the farm boy that Superman is, and you understand his ties to Smallville and how he's taking that to Metropolis.
Okay, okay. Good pick. Yeah, that's another beloved series that I haven't read, mm-hmm. so I'm going to have to check that out. Thank you for that recommendation. All right.
You are quite welcome.
Well, I've got one that I think is going to be a no-brainer for you, sir. Mm-hmm. Norm Breyfogle died at age 58. So, I mean, obviously, I found him on Detective Comics where he broke out there, and then he obviously went on to work on Batman, went to work on Shadow of the Bat, most of that with Alan Grant. He co-created the ventriloquist in Scarface, which had become just part of the DNA of Batman's mm-hmm. bad guys. Also co-created Mr. Zaz? I don't know how you say
Zaz.
That. Zaz. There you go. Thank you. And then, near to my heart, he co-created Ultra versus Prime. And when I think of Norm Breyfogle, like, I think of the silhouettes he would do. Like, he did mm-hmm. amazing silhouettes of people. He had great with emotion, great with motion. And then one of the things I loved when he would do Batman was he would show how other people, like bad guys, perceive Batman. When Batman's like scares them, Batman would look crazy, almost like an exaggerated monster. But it was to show how the people were seeing Batman, not how he actually looked. And that was fantastic. It just blew me away. Oh, so such a great talent.
I have sung his praises on the Batpod. I will sing his praises again. Dynamic is the word I use.
Mm.
And you're talking about an artist that came around just before Batman really got big, and he did not change his style to kind of conform to the movie.
Yeah,
He defined an era of Batman, because you saw artists kind of following his lead. Just a phenomenal storyteller. His art is just above board, and it's a defining artist for my Batman phase, you could say.
I think you're still stuck in it, if I heard.
I haven't left yet, yeah.
If I were to tell anyone to go read anything of his, I would probably point them towards his Detective Comics run that he did with Alan Grant, the earliest stuff he did on Batman. That's where I fell in love with him. In fact, the issue that I fell in love with him, you guys were nice enough to invite me on the Batpod to talk about, with Catman. Really great, great stuff by Norm Breyfogle.
We were legally obligated, so.
So who's your next pick, buddy?
John Cassaday.
Ooh, okay.
Who is an artist that redefined how I see Captain America. Before we had Chris Evans, we had John Cassaday doing this realistic version of Cap.
Mm-hmm.
And it resonated with me more than, say, Alex Ross's version. But if you've ever read The Planetary, that's where John Cassaday shined. Just absolutely gorgeous, detailed art. And yes, it was frustrating for the delays.
Mm-hmm.
Worth it in the end. And if you want another great run, Astonishing X-Men with him and the writer that wrote Buffy.
Right, right.
Great run.
I've read a few of those issues, yeah.
It's just, he was extremely young. I think he had a lot more to give. So it was something where we're not trying to be sad. We're celebrating these people.
Exactly.
I love what he gave us, but I think there was so much more that all of these artists could have given us.
I didn't actually know until preparing for this episode, when you gave me your list, I didn't know he'd passed away. I missed mm-hmm. that somehow. I read, as I mentioned, a few of those issues of X-Men, and then I read a fair chunk of Star Wars comics, actually, that he drew. And he did a really nice job on those Star Wars comics. He really did. But I probably need to read more from him. So maybe I need to read that X-Men run, and then you said Planetary is very good?
Planetary is excellent as a whole, yeah.
Okay. No. All right. We're only going to do four here, by the way, folks. We're each picking two, because I want to hear some names from you folks at home as well. In fact, before I name my final one, I'll tell you guys other names I considered.
Mm-hmm.
I came very, very close to picking Dave Stevens.
Oh, man.
Right. The Rocketeer. Those insane, amazing Who's Who entries that he did that, quite frankly, probably pushed a lot of young men into puberty. Just amazing artist. Just wow. So I thought a lot about using him. Darwin Cook.
Mm-hmm. That was one that was very close to mine. I have a Darwin Cook tattoo, so it felt a little obvious.
There we go. Okay. Yeah. And if you've never read New Frontier, you've got to. Mark Gruenwald, you know, Squadron Supreme, tons of stuff over at Marvel, all the Captain America he wrote. I mean, I really believe that Mark Gruenwald, if he hadn't passed away, he would have come over to DC and he would have had a pretty epic run on Justice League. I really do think he would have.
Oh, that would have been phenomenal.
Yep. Dwayne McDuffie, another mm-hmm. great one, right? Milestone Comics. For me personally, Firestorm. He wrote some great Justice Leagues. I mean, stuff he did with animation. What a talent. What a talent. So young. And then Kim Yale, you know, John Ostrander's wife back then, you know, who wrote, helped with Suicide Squad and Manhunter. She helped reinvent Barbara Gordon. Another talent gone too young as well. But my final pick is Mike Wieringo.
Mm.
Died age 44, incredibly young. If you're not familiar with him, he had an amazing run on The Flash with Mark Wade. He had a great run on Sensational Spider-Man with Tom DiZzago, and then Fantastic Four again with Mark Wade. And he had his own creator-owned series called Tell Us, which you still see some of that artwork out there, like the anthropomorphic tiger and stuff. And he co-created Bart Allen, you know, Impulse. and he had incredibly expressive faces, great sense of motion. And one thing I loved about him, he would do these very chunky, solid bodies. Because, you know, usually when you think of a speedster like Wally, they're very skinny, very thin, you know, rail thin, like a marathon runner. Nope, not in Mike Waringo's pen. They were big and chunky and solid, and it looked great. A little bit, almost like an Ed McGuinness kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like they, you know, solid. And the Ringo Award, you may have heard of, was actually, you know, created in his name after he passed. I don't know, did you have any exposure with Mike Waringo?
Oh, yeah. He's my absolute favorite Flash artist, bar none.
Yeah, same here. So good. That run. So, and it was Mark Waid, you know, really shining on at Flash at the same time. So you had two creators at the top of their game with a perfect character for them. It was so stinking good.
It was such a good run. And I recommend it to everybody. Keep an eye out on Amazon, Comixology. Mm-hmm. They will run sales quite often. And that's how I've ended up with an entire digital run of that volume of Flash. And it's 100% worth it.
Oh, okay. Good call. Well, folks, we want to hear some more suggestions from you, people that we lost too young, what you loved about their work, and even if the people we already mentioned, tell us the stories that connected with you. So just want to be part of the conversation. Again, we're not here to be sad about it, but to celebrate the amazing work that they gave us, you know?
You cannot have grief without gratitude.
Oh, that's really nice. It's very, very thoughtful. I was really hoping you would bring some really insightful stuff because I forgot to mention to you, you know, you're the follow-up guest to Matt Wagner and John K. Schneider III, so no pressure to be amazing or anything, but that's who you're following. I'm just saying.
Oh, well, I'm fine. I got a moment. Did you just render me speechless?
What you don't know, folks, is my software just edited out the incredibly long pause where Dave was frozen completely.
Deer in the headlights. It's like, hey, Freddie Mercury just went on. Why don't you go on stage after him? Right, exactly. I can't follow Radio Gaga.
Taylor Swift, finish your set. You're up. All right,
I'd
folks.
Be fine with that.
Aw. Well, we are going to get into Justice Society of America number 4. And if you want to see a few images from this issue, you can go out to our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA, and look for the gallery there. But more importantly, go dig it out of your long boxes or read it on digitally. However, because this is a fun story. Published by DC Comics, cover dated July 1991. On the shelves, May 21st, 1991. Cover price $1, so 4 shiny quarters. And the cover is by Tom Lyle. You want to describe the cover for us?
Yeah, this one was harder than I thought. We're kind of looking down at a desert scene, mm-hmm. kind of a Batman 66 Dutch-style angle, and a woman made of light who has chains on her wrist that you can barely see fires this Cyclops optic beam past Hawkman and hits a tank on the ground below.
So, do you like the cover? What do you think?
I do like it, and I'll tell you why. I mean, the content, if you take it, that description, it sounds very dry, mm-hmm. but the angle of it and Hawkman's wings, they give a certain flow, and it's like, that's really dynamic when you look at it.
And I think you're right. I agree. Like, there's not a lot to it, but it's that angle that makes it work, right? Also, you mentioned Hawkman's wing. I love you mentioned that, because for me, what jumped out at me is the wingspan of Hawkman, because mm-hmm. it normally when you see him, you don't really see his full wingspan. Usually the wings are, like, folded under, or they're bunched up or whatever, so they fit in a panel. Here, they've made the figure of Hawkman fairly small, so you're able to see that his wings are, oh my gosh, what is that, 20 feet across at least, probably?
Minimum, yeah.
Yeah, they're huge. So I do like that. And again, the angle works. And as a reader of this series, we've already seen this woman in previous issues. So now we know who she is. We're used to these living constellations. So there's nothing too shocking, but it works. It's effective. I don't know if I hadn't been reading this comic, if this would have made me pick it up. But certainly, you know, it's well, she's attractive, so that helps. But yeah, it works. By the way, I'm looking at this thing digitally and physically. I've got the physical copy and my digital copy. And the Justice Society of America logo on the digital, they've really cranked up like the comic. Contrast on that, where Justice Society's in red, then it's got a blue shadow effect on it with a yellow box behind it. And digitally, it's really, like, the red and the blue actually kind of hurt my eyes looking at it together digitally.
They practically glow.
Yeah, but the physical copy, it's the color's much better. It's much darker. The red and the yellow and the blue contrast quite well. The blue is so dark, it's almost a gray, so it does not as bothersome. So I do think this is one of those that the coloring, you know, I'm sure they follow the original color codes is what they do. But the paper ate the color in such a way that it worked better physically, I think. All right, well, let's get inside, folks. So the writer is Len Strazewski. Penciler is Tom Artis. This is a new artist, our fourth artist on the series so far. Inker is Frank McLaughlin. Letter is Janice Chiang. Colorist is Tom Zucchio. Editors are Brian Augustine and Mike like gold. This is Vengeance from the Stars, Chapter 4, Evil of the Ancients. You want to start us off, buddy?
I shall. Carter Hall, aka Hawkman, is in New Mexico to see cave drawings found in the cliff dwellings by museum owner William Wild Eagle. William reached out to Carter after seeing Hall talk on television about similar cave paintings in France. The images depict a hawk, a pegasus, and a wolf attacking ancient people. Some of this we've seen before. Carter suggests a concept of racial memory, a common remembrance of something so traumatic that transcends time and race. Like the pictures of Shag's feet that he constantly posts.
Oh my gosh.
David Ace Gutierrez just yelled to the stars. Just as Carter finishes his theory, the ground shakes and the duo are worried about another A-bomb test, which takes place quite often in this area. Instead, we get a giant woman made of light, which Carter immediately recognizes as Andromeda. The living constellation is heading for the Warhead Depot, and Carter has Will take him back to town and the museum, where he suits up as Hawkman and grabs a Native American spear and shield. Fully equipped, Hawkman pursues his new adversary.
Well, I'll take it from here. Hawkman finally catches up to Andromeda just as the military launches an all-out assault. Their weapons, however, prove useless against the mysterious energy being. Andromeda turns her fury on Hawkman, but his wooden shield unexpectedly protects him from her attacks. Realizing he's found a weakness, Hawkman slams into her with his shield and urges the soldiers to construct a massive wooden battering ram. Pressing the advantage, Hawkman wounds Andromeda with his spear, but she quickly retaliates with a chain that appears far more solid than the rest of her shifting form. Grabbing hold of the chain, Hawkman manages to hold her off for a moment until Andromeda transforms into a gigantic winged horse and sends him flying. The monstrous steed crashes into a military bunker, stealing several A-bomb warheads, and takes to the skies. Hawkman makes one desperate attempt to stop her, but without his shield, Andromeda's energy disrupts his nth metal gear, causing him to plummet from the sky. Fortunately, a returning Flash races in from Nevada and catches Hawkman before he hits the ground. Together, the heroes can only watch as Andromeda, carrying her deadly cargo, disappears into the distance. Next issue, the Flash and Hawkman together again. All right, buddy. So what'd you think of this issue?
You know, I don't know how this was perceived in 1991. I remember reading an issue here or there, but if you read this, you're not seeing the team together per se. I don't know how that went over in 2026. This is the reunion movie or TV season. This is the legacy. This is Picard season 3, and I'm here for it.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because there was actually a lot of backlash. People are like, you know, this is the Justice Society of America. Why is it only one member? Because for the first four issues, they specifically highlighted just one character. And then the next two issues, issues 5 and 6, are little team-ups. So, like, issue 5 will have Hawkman and the Flash, and the following issue has another team-up of two characters. And then finally, 7 and 8 are the whole team together. So they were very purposely trying to construct this story, like you said, a bit like a reunion where they introduce each character that builds and builds and builds. But people had no patience for that back then. They got blasted a lot for it, even though they explained it in the letters page over and over. But people seemed to just not be okay with that. And personally, I agree with you. I think this works really well.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's clearly they're further down the timeline that we've seen them. We see them with the McCarthy trials and how they end. But this is sort of the what's Worf up to now? What are Deanna and Will are married? I think this has aged really well in an era where we have a lot of legacy sequels.
Good point. That's right. In 1991, legacy was still kind of a new concept for DC. Yep.
Now, I went and drank the Kool-Aid, and I told you I read the Secret Origins issue of this version of Hawkman, because I'm more familiar with Katar than Carter.
Okay.
Space cop versus Egyptian prince. But I went back and I realized this makes me think of the 1932 version of the Mummy. Are you familiar with the Universal Monsters?
Well, certainly, but I've never seen the original Mummy. No, I'm more the Brendan Fraser Mummy era.
And there's nothing wrong with that. There's two really good Mummy movies from Brendan Fraser and a third one on the way. There's one you can ignore. If Rachel Weisz isn't in it, it's not worth watching.
Fair enough.
But the original had Boris Karloff, and it was this moody piece. I mean, it was really Dracula with a different theme. But the reason that I kept thinking about this was that was inspired because it was the discovery of, we're going to call him King Tut's tomb. It's a longer name, but I don't have that energy. And the person that found that tomb was an archaeologist named Howard Carter.
Oh, true.
Now, I thought for a minute, like, maybe that's where the inspiration came from. But no, I mean, apparently Gardner Fox just happened to see a bird building a nest and thought, lawman. But I love that... that adventurous feel, because the Mummy movies, they get progressively weirder and more comical, but they're adventure movies more than horror movies. And Hawkman fits right into that.
I like that. I like that quite a bit. And I can totally see, you know, looking at the makeup of at least the Mummy movies I'm familiar with, seeing this sort of, you know, adventure in 1940s kind of getting in there and having, you know, Carter sort of in half Indiana Jones, half superhero. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I kind of want to go down the Golden Age Hawkman rabbit hole now, but that's for another time.
You know, I love that the archaeology is in here. We get to see his background. The only thing I feel like we're missing is Shira. I would have loved to see her on the archaeological dig with him. Obviously, they made a conscious decision not to include her in this miniseries, but I think she would have fit well.
I would have liked to. Yeah, that was something I was notably absent.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just because the number of characters we have here, because we've got the addition of William Wild Eagle.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not named until page 6. So I thought this might have been a character that was in the oeuvre at the time. But we get to page 6 and he does say his name eventually. And we get this huge exposition dump. I mean, it's just like, I'm only a museum owner. It's like the, remember the Chris Farley bit in Wayne's World where he talks about how the guy is going to be traveling down this road at this time? It's like, that's an awful lot of information.
it did seem, I didn't notice it until I read your notes. And then when I reread the issue, I'm like, oh yeah, there's a whole, yeah. Just here's my whole life story in one, you know, one giant word balloon. Like, okay.
But I like the character. Yeah. I'd like to have seen more of him.
Yeah, there's actually a point in the story where William drives Carter to the museum, drops him off. And I thought William said he was going to go to the Army testing HQ. Maybe I misunderstood that. But I feel like there was a missed opportunity there where William could have gone there and he could have been, like, you know, in danger. And Hawkman would have been having to just try and save him. Because as it worked out, it's just Hawkman trying to save a bunch of military guys. And there's nothing wrong with that. But we just didn't have any emotional connection to these new soldiers we just met. So having William there would have, I think, carried through a little more, I don't know, drama for the story.
Yeah, and I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. So this version of Hawkman, the headgear, not my favorite. Not my least favorite. That's the latter-day Earth 2 version where it got more metal to distinguish him from Katara. Oh, it was goofy.
Right. You don't like the luchador mask he wears, basically? No.
This isn't bad. It makes sense. I'll say that. Because his headgear, like the Joe Kubert version, I mean, it looks like it weighs a ton.
Right.
So this one makes sense. It's sleek and it does distinguish him from the Earth One, or at this case, the latter day version.
Right.
But I love the Superpowers headpiece. And incidentally, Hawkman, in my opinion, was the single coolest figure in the first wave of Superpowers figures. And maybe you've heard of those.
I'm glad you specified first wave, because mm-hmm. we would have had an argument if we were including second wave in there.
Oh, that's Red Tornado.
Oh, you're so deluded. Oh my gosh. it's Firestorm first, then Dr. Fate, then maybe Green Arrow, Red Tornado, maybe at the, you know, towards the end there.
Who had the best power action?
Well, I mean, spinning legs is cool, but mm-hmm. but didn't Flash have that first? Or who was he the first? You know what? We're going down a rabbit hole here.
I'm just saying, Hawkman had extra appendages.
That's true. It is a cool looking figure. It is a really good looking Superpowers figure.
But anyway, for those that like Superpowers, maybe Shag's heard of them.
Yes, we've done some episodes on them. In fact, Chris Franklin did an amazing retrospective for the 40th anniversary, I think it was. And a huge, epic a podcast you guys should listen to.
And then I thought you'd have grown out of them by then. Weren't you in college at that point?
When Superpowers came out? I was 12 years old. Thank you very much.
I don't believe you.
Man, calling me old. All right, maybe you're not my favorite podcaster anymore. Just saying.
I'm not that far behind you, if we're being honest. I've done the math and it hurts.
Right. I mean, yeah, this comic alone, dude, is 35 years old. So, ouch.
You know the gif that they take from Saving Private Ryan where Matt Damon morphs into the old guy? That's what I'm feeling right now.
Isn't that Benjamin Buttons or whatever? Or is that from
Private? No, it's Saving Private Ryan at the end. Oh, I mean, you probably don't remember because that was heartbreaking, but we got way off on a tangent.
We really did. I was going to start talking about more gifs, but all right, we're going to pull this right back. All right, so let's talk about this.
Andromeda.
There we go.
Now, I'm more familiar with Clash of the Titans.
Okay.
And that had her chained up as a sacrifice to the Kraken. There's actually precedent for that.
Mm-hmm.
In the Greco mythology, Cassiopeia ticked off Poseidon by saying she and Andromeda were prettier than his nymphs.
Okay.
So he sent a monster, and sure enough, Andromeda was chained as a sacrifice. So, and by the way, I only speak of the 1981 version of Clash of the Titans.
Oh, I was assumed. Yeah, I mean, Harry Hamlin all the way. I haven't seen it many, many, many years, but boy, back in the day, I think I watched it every other day on cable. So, very fair. So we're talking about Andromeda. I'll just mention a couple things. Like page 8, when she shows up, it's a really effective splash page. I mean, she takes up the whole page. She's blinding light pouring out of her. The guys are covering their eyes. She's so bright with Carter and William, really tiny. So it really gives you a scale of it. Looks phenomenal. And I'm going to be that guy. And I'm just going to put her right. I mean, my name is Irredeemable. You knew that going in, guys. She is smoking hot. I mean, mm-hmm. Tom Artis, the guy who drew this, was known for drawing really cute, attractive women. Like, for example, like the Zatanna Who's Who entry comes to mind. It looks nothing like Zatanna, but she's super cute in it. So, Andromeda definitely catches the eye. But there's one thing I do wonder about. Like, is it too much of a mental leap for Carter to immediately go from seeing her to making the connection to the cave painting, which, you know, was done thousands of years ago with berries and animal fat, to go, oh, that's the same lady. Like, that felt like that was a bit of a leap too much for me. What about you?
I will earn my baldy here, because we don't do no prizes on DC, but... Carter has apparently been studying these cave paintings for quite a while. He's been several places around the world.
True.
So the symbolism of her with chains, it would be on his mind. So it's something where it's in his atmosphere, and he's probably looked at reference material, so on and so forth. So it's not completely out of the pale, or okay, beyond the pale.
All right. We will allow it then.
But yeah, it was a little quick, but I kind of get it because he's been in that. And let's be honest here. Pegasus, we get a Pegasus. I was trying to figure out what's not tied to Andromeda directly.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, but the Andromeda Galaxy and the Pegasus Galley are next to each other. So those constellations are near each other. So the switch out kind of makes sense.
That does make sense. Yeah, because, I mean, all of these transformations we've been seeing from, you know, the constellation humanoid figure to the animal, you've had to kind of thread the needle to figure out the connection. So that one makes a lot of sense, actually, for the galaxies. Yep.
So it took me a little bit there. And yes, I didn't get to use Google Maps this time, but I was close.
One of my favorite things about Dave's Daredevil podcast. I was just telling my wife about that.
The fact that I was able to give people in New York directions when I was in Manhattan. Yeah.
Even though you'd never been there, right?
And had never stepped foot in there. Yeah.
Oh, that is amazing.
Let's be honest here. When we come to the end of this, we just read a book in which a Pegasus made of living stars stole a whole bunch of atom bombs. I had to question my sobriety.
That's one of my notes, too. On page 18 and 19, the magical horse who's literally got three atomic warheads in its mouth is just absurdly strange. Like, it looks weird on the page, but, I mean, so is a guy with wings who's, you know, fighting with a shield. But it's just funny. It's just like, what am I looking at? Okay. And it's also fun and goofy at the same time.
Yeah. It's like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, except it's got a winged guy. Well, no, that's on brand, too.
Well, since we're talking about Andromeda, there's a couple other things. Before she transforms, there's a spot where she's fighting the soldiers, and they blast her with, like, a tank. And it goes through her arm, and she gets really angry. It's on page 12. And she has this crazy, like, monster face screaming after she's been shot. And it looks great. I mean, Tom Artis did a really nice job trying to show the anger and the rage, and kind of reminds me of, like, Ghostbusters, when the librarian ghost, you know, screams, goes, rah! Screams at them. It reminds me a lot of that.
That's a really good comparison, because she went from hot to not real fast.
Yep. Exactly right. Exactly right.
It's like Carter told her to calm down. That's the effect. If you've ever told your wife to calm down, you know to run.
Took me a minute to catch that. Yeah. I was trying to connect it to Ghostbusters, and I'm like, oh, no, he means in real life. Okay. Yeah. Got it. So I'm going to talk about Tom Artis for just a second here. So first off, as we mentioned, he's not with us anymore, sadly. But I always thought he had a great name, right? Tom Artis. So, I mean, if you're an artist, that's a fantastic name to have, right? First noticed his work I mentioned Zatanna, on his Secret Origins of Zatanna, and then the Who's Who entry. And he did a lot of books for DC about this time. He had done Spectre, the Doug Minch run. He did Tail Gunner Joe, which I've never actually read. I've always meant to. He had a run on She-Hulk over on Impact. He did The Web. So he did a lot of different things. And I like some of what he's done here. Like, right in the beginning, William Wild Eagle, you know, he's going through the caves and he's got this giant belt on. And it took me a minute to realize that's not his belt. He's got a second belt. He's got a belt holding up his pants, but that is his work belt. And so he's got, like, equipment hanging off of it. It's an unnecessary detail that didn't have to be there, but it just looks darn cool.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's like a tool belt. That makes perfect sense.
Yep, exactly right. Yeah. And then page 4 has a really nice close-up on Carter when he starts talking about race memory, which looks really great. And then throughout, his panel design is fine. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing also amazing about it. It's perfectly fine. It absolutely works. I never get confused. The storytelling's solid. But he does this one thing. Every so often, he'll do an inset, this strange little triangle inset. You can really see it on page 12 and 13 of Hawkman, like, giving commentary. At one point, he's like, oh, no, they blew up the tanks or whatever. So he does these little insets. Insults and triangles of a character, and I found that kind of interesting.
It makes me think of animation in a way. Almost like a Deadpool style commentary.
Okay.
I think it looks cool.
Yeah.
And it's really weird. It's out of sorts, but I like it.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, this is an era when artists were getting creative. I mean, 1991, come on, this is when, you know, all the folks at Marvel are killing it and they're about to become Image. So this is when people are trying different stuff, and that was an interesting thing to try. So what else you got on the issue?
I mean, really, when we got to the end, I mean, a lot of it's an action. The second half is pure action. I love Carter using his brain. And we've seen that a lot in this series as a whole. But then we get Jay, and I got really confused. That's where you kind of did the, I had to go back to issue one. Like, where did we leave Jay? I thought he was captured.
Okay.
We've seen Alan get captured. We've seen Dinah get captured. I'm like, where did we leave Jay? And I misread it because I thought he was going to Nevada. I'm like, oh, this is a weird timey-wimey thing. No, we just picked up the cliffhanger from issue number one.
So how did I'm honestly, I didn't go back and look myself. So I remember he fought the Constellation. I think he lost.
He got knocked out, and that was it.
Oh, so it ended with him unconscious. Okay. So you're right. I probably would have assumed he would have got grabbed up like everyone else. I mean, Starman, everyone's been getting grabbed up. Okay. All right. And there is a little bit of timey-wimey thing going on here, because issues 2, 3, and 4 all take place pretty much at the same time. In fact, in this issue, they reference power flickering at their hotels. And if you remember the previous issues, all that's tied together. They think it's just, you know, power flickering, but it's all tied to the power problems being caused by the constellations. So they've done a really interesting thing of connecting these issues all at the same time. And as you said, this picks up right after issue one. So that's pretty cool.
So here's a question I'll pose to you.
Okay.
I didn't put it in the notes, so I'm taking you by surprise.
I'm ready for it.
We are now halfway through this series.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts of the story, the first half? How do you feel it's flowing?
Well, I think, you know, for doing it for a podcast, you notice a lot more stuff, right? I think there's certain things I would have missed if I had read it, like the first previous times I've read it. I don't know that I caught that issue 2, 3, and 4 were taking place all at the same time. I don't know that I saw that previously. I can only speak to where I sit today and how I've been reading it. I think this is a really intelligently built series. Again, we talked about the progression of single character, and then moving towards teams. I like that. The villain, that'd be one criticism, is that you either reveal who the villain is or you don't reveal who the villain is. They've pretty much made it completely obvious it's, you know, Vandal Savage, but they still haven't said his name yet. I mean, we've seen him in the shadows, but he's got a beard. He fought in World War II. He's immortal. I mean, all the pieces are there. He's fought the JSA. It's clearly obvious it's him. So why they didn't name him, I don't know. So I would say so far, I'm really enjoying it. What about you?
I've been reading along with the show, and then I reread them to prep for this. The reread the back-to-back rereading is such a smooth read. I was so pleased. I think I would be frustrated with this coming out monthly.
Yeah.
But as a whole work, it ramps up perfectly. The timey-wimey makes sense because everything's happening simultaneously.
Right.
This is a very quick progression, and I think it really winds it up. So yeah, I was really pleased with this.
Okay. Awesome. Well, I do have some big picture thoughts I want to share at the end, but I want to run through a few other quick notes real quick. Let's see. I mentioned on a previous one, they mentioned Edward R. Murrow or made a reference to him. They did it again here. So clearly, Len is trying to get in some historical context there. I think probably when I read this in 1991, that might have been the first time I'd ever heard of racial memory. You know, the kind of fear that passed down genetically, it's so intense. I don't know that I really would have encountered that at that age. I don't think I would have.
Where would you have seen that at 12 years old?
Well, no, this is 1991. So 1991, I would have been 19. So philosophy class. No, when I was 12 years old was when the superpowers.
Oh, that's superpowers. You're right.
Yep,
sorry.
Yep. So interesting ideas, maybe. Also, I think they did a good job building some anxiety into this issue about the A-bomb tests. Like, they tell you that they're hanging out where they test the A-bombs. There's a couple of occurrences where they think they're, you know, that they suddenly got caught in an A-bomb test. You're kind of expecting Rick Jones out there with the gamma bomb sort of moments or whatever. But I kind of like that they were building that anxiety. And then Hawkman using ancient weapons, right? He always does. But I love here that since he's in New Mexico, he grabs some Native American weaponry. Very cool. Very, very appropriate for the era. I like that. But it does leave me with a question where Andromeda, she can blast apart a metal tank, but somehow this small little handheld wooden shield is invulnerable and can beat the tar out of her. I think it needs a little further explanation about how she has this weakness to wood, or maybe it's this specific relic. I don't know which, but I feel like that probably needed a better explanation.
I mean, we get enough of one to make it through the end of the issue. Oh, it's like Green Lantern. He's vulnerable to wood. Okay.
Yeah.
That didn't bother me as much when we made that comparison. But yeah, that's going to need to be expanded. And I resisted the urge to read ahead.
Good. I've reread the series in the last couple of years, but I haven't reread it probably in 3 years. So I don't really remember where this is going. So I just know we got team-ups ahead, which I'm looking forward to. I did think it's kind of funny that Flash is allergic to Hawkman's wings. That was adorable. And, you know, so our big picture here, you're asking about the series as a whole, but I'm going to say about this particular issue, it's a solid issue. I think it's a fun adventure. However, I do feel like this is the first issue in the series that feels a little light. And my reasons here is that, you know, we're with Carter the whole time, right? But I still didn't really get a good sense of who he is as a character. I mean, I do understand his archaeology background, got it. But I'm talking about his personality. You know, I feel like we got to know Jay Garrick in his issue. I feel like we got to know Dinah Lance. I feel like we got to know Alan Scott in those issues. I don't really feel like I know a lot about Carter, other than he's an archaeologist and he likes to help people. Mm-hmm. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
100%. That's why I went and read the Secret Origins version.
Ah, there we go. Okay. Yeah, I mean, and Shira barely even gets a mention in the issue. And, you know, when I think of this version of Carter, her and Shira is the most important thing to him ever. Mm-hmm. Also, this issue is, you know, it's basically, you know, cave exploration followed by a fight. And the fight just didn't, it sounds more critical than I probably should be, but it didn't have the same energy as the earlier issues, right? Like those fights, they just kept evolving. There'd be different opponents in different locations and complications. Like, you know, think about that Black Canary fight, right? She battles the goons in the museum. Then she's fighting Solomon Grundy. Then they're battling and they go crashing through a window. Then they continue their fight in the alley. You know, different elements kept coming in. Here, the confrontation pretty much stays pretty much the same. It's just hitting her with something wood over and over from beginning to end. You know, they fight in the desert, she transforms into a horse, and then it's over. It never really escalated or changed in a way that made it feel dynamic to me.
And I 100% agree, and that was one of my internal criticisms, was just, it's repetitive. Once we go into the action, it's rinse, lather, repeat. Oh, now she's a horse, rinse, lather, repeat.
Yeah, yeah. So it's, again, it's not bad. I'm not trying to say it's bad at all. It was fun. It just didn't feel quite as epic or grand as the previous ones. And, you know what? We mentioned Vandal Savage. This is the first issue that we don't have cutaways with the quote-unquote mystery villain taunting Starman. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that was, it's a very brisk issue. It's one of the more brisk, the most brisk issues so far.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like maybe it was a little fluff, and that's not necessarily a criticism, but if you've got 8 issues to fill, somewhere there's going to be some fluff, and this just happened to be it. It also doesn't give us a lot about Carter's powers.
Okay.
He mentions the nth metal, but that's about it. Now, if you read the Hawkman, that's pretty much how they introduce it. Like, oh, I've made this metal. So it is very casual, and that's how they did it in the Golden Age, so it does fit with that, but I feel like there could have been a little bit more clarification there, that those wings don't really do anything, per se.
I didn't think about that. You make a great point, right? Where, you know, normally, yeah, you hear all kinds of stuff about his nth metal, and that's why he flies on it. But yeah, it's just a casual one-off reference. I mean, as far as you know going into this, he's just a guy who can fly, and he's an archaeologist. So that's really about it. Well, I don't really have anything further to say specifically on the issue. I will mention the letters page. It does talk about the upcoming All-Star Archives. Those were those giant $50 hardcovers, you know, that would collect stuff. I bought the JLA archives. I remember shelling up and saving money as they would come out. But do you ever get any of those archive books?
Right now I have 3. One is a Shazam, courtesy of Michael Bailey, and 2 are the Starman archives, because I'm a fan of the Ted Knight Starman.
Right, right. We're going to get more Ted Knight upcoming issues, so that'll be nice. Well, Dave, I think it is time for us to nominate the All-Star Award. This is where we nominate our favorite moment from the issue, whether it be a story beat, something in the art, something that made us laugh, you know, whatever. Both myself and Dave will pick one moment at each to spotlight, and those moments will earn an All-Star Award. Well, Dave, you're the guest, so why don't you tell me your pick for your All-Star Award?
I really want to cheat and tie 2 events, but I had to choose one, so I went with the last page where Carter and Jay are watching this horse fly away, and just, you can tell the absurdity is crashing down on them. That's a good ending to the issue.
That's a lot of fun. And also, friends reunited, which is great. Like you said, it's getting the band back together. It's Star Trek the motion picture, the first 30 minutes. You know, it's putting it all back together. So yeah, I like that. That's good. My pick, I went for that splash page on page 8, where you first see Andromeda. She is huge. She's filled the entire sky. Tom Artis did a fantastic job giving you the scope and the scale of this villain. And also, it's a nice contract where you know she's the bad guy, but she's also very beautiful. And you see them covering their eyes, and it looks great. And actually, I just now noticing her appearance, it almost looks like an atom bomb blast. I didn't even think about that. But the bright light behind her, is designed to almost look like that. So that's where my award's going. So I think they're both equally great moments. So congratulations to Andromeda. Congratulations to old friends being reunited. You both have won an All-Star Award. Please wear it with pride. It is as tangible as our love for these moments. Now, Dave, I got to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging out here in the desert and helping sort of clean up the mess created by Andromeda? Maybe protect the archaeological dig? And worst case, by the way, if you do this, you know, like if an atom bomb were to happen to go off, comics have taught me that you should pretty much at least gain superpowers from that.
Possibly. I still don't roll the dice. I get under my Formica desk like they taught me in elementary school because that'll protect me. Yeah, I'll get a broom and a dustpan and get this thing cleaned up.
Thank you so much, Dave. And don't worry, we will bring you back at the end of the show. But after this podcast promo break, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called The Society Pages.
Grab your bat microphone. It's time to start the show.
Welcome to the Bat Pod, a Batman comic book discussion podcast.
Whoa, what are you doing? That's my line.
I'm starting the show. I was waiting on you. We're starting the show.
I'm the one that says that. You're my new co-host, where we talk about back issues of Batman. Could be in Detective Comics, World Finest.
Could we do some Shadow of the Bat and maybe some Nightwing, maybe some Batgirl?
Absolutely.
Can we also define where my co-hosting parameters start and end? I can't start the show, but I can definitely co-host it.
Well, maybe we'll let you start the show.
Okay, at least I get to pick one of the books we're covering on each episode, and you can pick the other?
Absolutely.
Can I close out the show? Can I bring friends? Will there be snacks?
What is your favorite bat snack?
Cucumber sandwiches.
Join Bill Beer and J. David Weider every 2 weeks on the Bat Pod. You can find us on your favorite podcast app.
Grab your headphones, listen up. You know you love it. Drop the facade. Like the Dark Knight Detective, they've got some perspective. They're a pure crime-fighting collective. It's the Bat Pod.
...1938. Americans are climbing out of the Great Depression, even as another world war looms on the horizon. Murderers and madmen prey on the helpless and the innocent.
In this time, two restless souls emerge as lights in the darkness.
Insomniac Wesley Dodds, haunted by unspeakable dreams, driven to fight evil as a masked vigilante.
Socialite Diane Belmont, searching for purpose, drawn into a world of mystery and danger.
The wicked beware, for when Wesley and Diane come together, no one can escape the Sandman's dark dream.
Justice Society presents The Sandman Slept Here, covering Vertigo's Sandman Mystery Theater, one story at a time. Hosted by Ryan Daly,
Paul Ken,
and Max Romero.
Find it on the Justice Society Presents feed.
Part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Dream a little dream.
The Society Pages. The Society Pages is the segment of the show where we cover your feedback from the previous episodes. Now, I do want to say real quick before we get started, I just finished attending Heroes Con, as we mentioned here on the episode, but I did get a chance to chat with John K. Schneider III again. He is such a nice guy. And folks, let me tell you, if I have my way, you'll be hearing his voice again on this podcast in the future once we get to JSA in the 2000s, because he does have a JSA adjacent book he worked on. So let's keep our fingers crossed and hopefully we'll have him on the show again. Now, remember, folks, as we get into this, you go find us on social media as JSA Presents, because as we always say, it is about building an online community of JSA fans around the show. Now, just a quick request. If you have not left an iTunes or Apple Podcast review, please consider doing that. It really does help raise the profile of the show and attract new listeners. All you got to do is look on iTunes or Apple Podcasts for Justice Society Presents. And as a thank you, I will read your entire iTunes and Apple Podcast review on the air. If you enjoy the show, it's something you can do with no cost, just a few moments of your time, and it would mean a lot to us. Now, I am going to get into your feedback from the last two episodes because we didn't do feedback last time. So we're going to be covering the feedback from both our coverage of JSA number 3 with my guest Dave Tomko, from the 1991 miniseries, and also the episode with Matt Wagner and John K. Schneider III, where we did an interview with them. And I can't believe I can actually get a chance to say those words together in a sentence that I interviewed those two. Unbelievable. So I have taken all of your feedback from comments from our website and put into a Google document, and what I could find on social media. It's very, very long. So I'm going to just name check everyone and also read just a portion of your comments so that we can get through all of this. But again, you should go out to our website and read everybody's feedback, because it's all really worthwhile stuff. And again, I'm gonna try and read big chunks of it, so you're going to get a good taste of it here. So first up, we're going to cover your feedback on Justice Society of America, number 3 from 1991, with my guest Dave Tomko. First up, we heard from Hal. Now, in that episode, the discussion topic that we tackled was who had, of the JSA, had the coolest secret identity job. Well, Hal kind of threads the needle here, connecting Black Canary to Oliver Queen, and says that for Oliver Queen, at least in one story, he was a professor and archaeologist with particular interest in Native American indigenous culture. It was that interest which led him to visit Las Mesa, where he first met the Golden Age Speedy. I'm not sure if it was ever referenced again. That is a pretty cool connection. I actually knew a little bit about that and had forgotten that, so thank you, Hal. Then he goes on to say, Shag kind of chuckled at the convenience of a wooden phone booth that Solomon Grundy threw at Green Lantern, but in my city, there's actually an antique wooden phone booth at the courthouse, or at least here, it used to be the last time I was there. Apparently, wooden phone booths were quite common in the 1940s. That's a good point, Hal. I did probably crack a joke about it, but yeah, it makes perfect sense. Then chiming in on Hal's thoughts is Dave Tomko, guest of that particular episode. Also, he has his website, New Earth 2. Dave says, after recording, I did think that I'd probably throw Hawk Girl into the archaeologist category, and Dan Garrett, the Blue Beetle from the newly retconned Justice Society Dark, was also an archaeologist. Good point, Dave. Thank you. And boy, archaeologists and superheroes, those seem to go hand in hand, don't they? Then we heard from Rob McCarthy, author of the book The Star, The Space Princess, and other stories. Rob addresses the topics that was still going in the feedback at that point about Wonder Woman and the retcon putting her in World War II. Rob says, sometime flapdoodle making a World War II Wonder Woman will always be a better idea than, quote, Superboy grew up into Superman. Superboy was in the same small town as Clark Kent, and Luther was there, and then Superman shows up in Metropolis? How many seconds does it take Lois to figure it out? That's a good point, Rob. And then Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel, chimes in on that. He says, I've always been okay with Superboy happening for Superman, but what I'm not happy about is how Superdog just vanished when he grew up. That's a good point about Crypto. But Martin Gray comes into the rescue. Martin Gray, of course, from the Too Dangerous for Girl blog. Martin says, Superman and Crypto were reunited in 1975. Superman number 287, Bucky. The Dog of Steel has been romping in space. Oh, well, thank you, Martin. I think everybody loves Crypto nowadays, so that makes us happy to hear. Then we're from Anthony Cardino, who has his own blog. He says, hi, guys. Longtime listener, first-time commenter. Okay, well, not quite so long, but Shag knows I've been working hard to listen to the whole JSA Presents feed in order, and I'm finally caught up. Anthony says, in your list of JSA secret identity jobs, I noticed you didn't mention the Spectre. Okay, he was dead, but if I recall correctly, throughout the Golden Age, Jim Corrigan still worked as a cop because no one else knew he was dead. No, you're absolutely right, Anthony. Maybe we missed Jim Corrigan? I don't really know. I mean, he was on our list to discuss. It's possible I didn't say it if I just dropped the ball, but yeah, absolutely. Being a police detective for Jim Corrigan was a great job. Then Anthony goes on to say, in terms of other best, most interesting secret identity jobs, I recently reread All-Star Comics number 58 as part of my random comic book back issue reread project on my Instagram account, and I'm pretty much forgotten that Dick Grayson's tenure as a United States ambassador to South Africa and his strong anti-apartheid stance that's got to be unique among superheroes' secret identity jobs. Anthony, that's a great one. Once I read your comment, I was just punching myself for not thinking of that, because All-Star Comics number 58 is one of my absolutely beloved JSA issues, and I always think about Dick Grayson being an ambassador in that regard, and I should have absolutely included him, so that's a good one. Thank you so much. Now, as Anthony mentioned, he does have his random comic book back issue reread over on Instagram, and he did do one on Justice Society of America number 3. And in that, he was very kindly said, now that I'm caught up on the JSA in the 90s podcast on JSA Presents, you can expect the rest of this run to pop up in this project over the next several months, whenever the Irredeemable Shag posts a new episode. And if you're a fan of the JSA and you're not listening to the Justice Society Presents podcast, trust me, it's well worth your time. Well, thank you, Anthony. I appreciate you giving us a shout out. Then we heard from Doug Adamson from the Brit Crisis Network, also the Monitor Tapes, a Crisis on Infinite Earths podcast. Doug says, I do like that the JSA all seem to have day jobs and weren't billionaires who can fund everything at the drop of a hat. I also like that the majority of the jobs were something to aspire to. Well, not Johnny Thunder, obviously. However, ironically, in today's economy, with zero-hour contracts and gig side jobs and hustles, he'd be considered a success. Then he says, lots of scientists of various means is always a good thing on a team. Of course, I also realize that these days, with so much location technology on smartphones, monitoring of staff and buildings and swipe cards, etc., being a superhero and holding a day job is really difficult. I mean, how many times can you pop out to use the loo or get coffee and donuts before HR starts asking about your health and suggesting you might have a medical condition that your doctor needs to discuss with you? This is why criminals in the DCU really need to stop operating at night and instead aim to cause mayhem around 10:30 in the morning, while many heroes with day jobs are likely in meetings or at work or mid-shift and can't excuse themselves for 20 minutes to defeat the bad guys. That's a good thought, Doug. That is a very good thought. Then he says, this episode itself was great fun, and Dave is a great guest to have on anything JSA-related. I do love how the Vandal Savage reveal is still not being made in the series. It's so cute that the team producing the book have no idea that marketing was spoiling all of their work. Well, thank you, Doug. Then we heard from Comic Foil, who, by the way, I got a chance to meet him at Heroes Con. He stopped me at the convention, and we got a chance to chat for a minute, so that was really cool. Comic Foil says, the only problem with enjoying this podcast on my long drives is that I forget the questions you bring up and the thoughts I had on the issue. Suffice to say, I was very entertained and always enjoyed the JSA Presents podcast, also hoping for a bigger Starman presence eventually. Come on, Ted, you can throw off the shackles of Vandal Savage? Well, thank you, Comic Foil, I appreciate it. Then we heard from Super Captain, who says, I love the episode, and Alan Scott has long been my favorite GL. However, his oath is harder for me to remember because it doesn't have the rhyme and meter of Hal's oath. Absolutely true, Super Captain. And then he says, and those facial expressions on young Johnny in this issue were outstanding when he is sent to get coffee and donuts. You almost feel his excitement deflate. Yeah, you're not kidding. Mike Parabek did an amazing job drawing Johnny the office assistant. Then Super Captain goes on to say, I'm not sure that Vandal Savage did have any appearances in All-Star Squadron or Infinity Inc. out of cameos and flashbacks in a panel or two. So yeah, that is really interesting that Vandal Savage, you know, he fought the JSA back in, you know, obviously the Golden Age. He fought them in the Bronze Age. Then he really doesn't bump into him again till this miniseries. So sort of interesting that, nowadays we think of him, you know, synonymously with the JSA. But here it was kind of, you know, putting the pieces back together. All right, then we're from Mark Baker Wright from Black Rock's Toy Box and Not Your Father's Autobot podcast. Now, if you recall in the last episode, Dave Tomko, the guest, suggested that Alan Scott had a bit of a hair temper and was sometimes a jerk. So Mark addresses that, says, I've never really thought of Alan being a person with a bad attitude or who treated others with disrespect. Although, upon rereading this issue, I suppose I can see what Dave may have been talking about. I still say he did and said nothing out of line that wouldn't be expected of a leader of a broadcast company who found its power suddenly cut despite systems in place to ensure that such a thing should never happen. I won't deny the possibility that Alan may have been a more persistent bad attitude, just that it's never been how he's come off to me. But like Shag, I confess that most of my experience of Alan comes in from later adventures. I'll try to review his stories in the future with this perspective in mind. Well, I mean, I did think of one, Mark, was again in the 1982 JSA series. He loses his cool and destroys a television set when they air something that he didn't like on his own network. So, I mean, he had a temper there too. So it could be something worth investigating. Then Jose A. Rivera, author of The Underground Adventures, says, what can I say about Mike Parabek's art other than it's amazing? He makes Alan so dynamic, especially with the cape. It makes me sad that he's no longer with us. Imagine what he would have gotten onto today. I can even see him doing one of the one-shots for the JSA Returns event. I think losing him and Dave Stevens are ones that hurt the most because the possibilities of what they would have done are endless. And you know, Jose, that is kind of what the theme of our discussion was this time. So yeah, we've lost a lot of amazingly talented comic book artists, for sure. Then we're from John Stibe, who's a past guest of the show. John says, great episode, guys. I just wanted to add my thoughts about the idea that Alan Scott was kind of a jerk in this issue. I've never looked at Alan that way. He and Jay were always the fun uncle characters whenever I read them. Maybe his bossy behavior in this issue was something similar to the Lou Grant character on Mary Tyler Moore. You know, a lovable, grumpy person in charge, but with a big heart. As far as him being that way with Jade or Obsidian, I can chalk that up to just him being a father. He was definitely protective of Jade, for example, with people she was dating, but he never seemed, again to me at least, to be a jerk. Well, John, I can think of one particular Green Lantern issue in the Kyle run where he was a jerk to Kyle. But that's because it's that whole sequence where he was aged young and Molly was the Harlequin again and all these things. But he did treat Kyle kind of crappy in that too. So maybe there are some precedents for this. I don't know. Maybe we need to look deeper at this. All right. Then we hear from Chris Franklin for the Firewater Podcast Network. He has shows such as the Mr. and Mrs. Superman right here on the JSA Presents podcast. And then also Batman Nightcast list and many more. Chris says, which JSA-er had the best career? I think Allen's probably my answer too. Lots of story potential there. Robinson did wonders with it in the Golden Age, for instance. I never understood why they didn't retcon Tenknight to be the professional scientist and not just an amateur. Robinson established that he, and not some other guy, really invented the gravity and cosmic rod. And he continued to the atomic bomb, much to the detriment of his mental health. Sounds like a bit more than a dabbler to me, doesn't it? And he says, interesting that Dave sees Alan's personality as a bit of a jerkish. I never really thought of him that way. Just maybe more stern than the jovial Jay, but less intense than Hawkman. But that may be retcons or later stories flavoring the soup. The truth is, before Marvel came along, and after the early rough-and-tumble pre-war Golden Age years, most comic book characters had interchangeable personalities, especially the DC heroes. That's a good point, Chris. That's fair. And then he says, I do believe Alan did make boxing gloves in the Golden Age, but the trope became a thing for Hal for sure, and as did the In Brightest Day oath, which Alan did originate. All right. Well, thank you for that. Then we're from Liz Ann Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz says, watching Alan at work is kind of cool, and then going out to fight the construct as well. And then poor Johnny, the office boy on the coffee run. We all start at the bottom. Yeah, Liz, people do tend to start at the bottom after work their way up, don't they? Then Nate the Great says, there was an issue of Mark Waid's Brave and the Bold where Alan Scott bit Hal Jordan's head off for having too many jobs. I mean, he wasn't a Guy Gardner type jerk, but was definitely wound too tightly. All right, so there's another example of Alan losing his cool. You know, I think Dave Tomko might be onto something. Then we heard from Lito Sandoval, who says, I got backlogged on comic podcasts this year, finally caught up, and I'm listening now to one of my favorite podcasts about one of my favorite teams. Also, had to look up if Vandal Savage ever appeared in All-Star Squadron, and the answer is no. I remember he was used in the Superman books at the time. All right. Thank you, Lito. I appreciate the research. Then we heard from Billy Hines, comic enabler. Says, a deep, nerdy dive by Shag and friends about a series I really like. The 10-issue JSA series drawn by Parabek is great. Feeling like I want to comment somewhere, but the ship has sailed. Still worth a listen. Well, Billy, you're always welcome to comment on the website and the back episodes. I may not cover it on the air, but it's still part of the conversation, or you can put it on social media and I'll see it there. So feel free to keep commenting, man. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Then I heard from Al, the comics guy. He says, currently enjoying your podcast and all the love you're showing the JSA lately. I found a DC preview book that was given out at conventions in 1991. It hypes all the upcoming important event books that would be released later this year. The lead feature is the JSA series that you're currently covering on your podcast, which to me means somebody had high hopes to promote that with all the other high-profile titles of the time. JSA all the way. Then he shared a couple pictures with me. It says DC Sneak Previews number one, and on the cover it's got Hal Jordan, and he's got the white temple. So clearly this is the ongoing series after Emerald Dawn. And then you've got the JSA running forward. And I'm looking now. Yeah, this is promoting Justice Society of America and Green Lantern Emerald Dawn 2, I believe is what that says. So yeah, and there's a little entry piece on the inside cover talking about the JSA, which talks about the miniseries, which does not actually give away that the bad guy's Vandal Savage. So at least one promotional piece didn't give it away. So interesting stuff. Thanks, Al. I appreciate that. I'm going to have to keep my eye out for that promo piece. All right, now moving on to our second podcast we're going to be discussing. That was the Dr. Midnight miniseries, again with my guests Matt Wagner and John K. Schneider III. And for a second time, I cannot believe I even get to say those words together in a sentence. So exciting. All right, first comment comes from Ryan Daly from the Firewater Podcast Network. He has shows such as The Sandman Slept Here, right here on the JSA Presents podcast feed, as well as Batman Nightcast and more. Ryan says, it's hard to leave feedback on an episode where you interview a creator because no one wants to be visibly or vocally critical of the interviewee who volunteered his or her their time for the podcast. And too much praise would sound insincere or just dumb, like, I really enjoyed how John told this story about his childhood. So I'll be the first to say that this episode was awful. Embarrassingly so. Every word Matt said rang false, like he was just giving you the answers you wanted to hear. And why didn't you press them more on their political and social opinions? And did you have to talk about Dr. Midnight so much? Ryan. And then he says, okay, enough of that nonsense. Great episode as always, Shag. Matt and John sounded like a blast to talk to, and I would have happily listened to another half hour of stories from them. Also, for all the other listeners, I backed Matt's Dracula graphic novels with Kelly Jones. Go out and get them. Thank you, Ryan. Appreciate that. Then we're from Mark Baker Wright again, who says, I echo Ryan's comments, perhaps precisely because I am not a fan of the art in this miniseries. I love the story itself, but the dark painterly style, while atmospheric, made it really hard for me to follow the story. Perhaps that's more to say about my tastes. I'm apparently more of a traditionalist when it comes to comic art. I find that I often dislike art that other fans praise for being different. More than anything else, I want to respect the creator's work, especially as regard to the art that he put in such long hours to achieve. My feelings are certainly not a reflection on the interview. Sounds like you all enjoyed yourselves immensely. Well, Mark, I appreciate your honest opinion. Folks, just so you know, Mark's a good buddy of mine. And as his name is Mark Baker Wright, when things like this come up, I often call him Mark Baker Wrong. So fair enough. Then we heard from Alexander Osias from the Armchair Gamer blog. Alex says, it was great to hear about the work that went into the creation of the new Dr. Midnight. Not only did I get reminded of the trends in comics and the industry situation of the time, I also got confirmation of the pulp re-inspiration of the modern character. Appreciated their approach at making him more of a doctor than just a name, and having assistants also added to the pulp feel. Well, thanks, Alex. Then we heard from Chris Mort, who says, I really enjoyed the interview. Shaggy always deliver top-notch content. It amazes me to listen to these gentlemen reminisce about cons that they were together at 1987. I can't remember who I was with at 7 a.m. this morning. After listening to these gentlemen's episode, I immediately went on eBay and bought the series. Again, thank you for helping me find my joy. Well, Chris, I hope you enjoy the series. It's phenomenal. Then we're from Bucky749 again, says, I have not read this Dr. Midnight series, but I've been doing a deep dive on the Red Bee and the original Golden Age Yellow Jacket and wondering why nobody has put these two together like a Power Man and Iron Fist team. Bucky, I don't know. The Red Bee and the Golden Age Yellow Jacket might just be fun. I don't know. Then we're from Brett Young from the Firewater Podcast Network. He has shows such as The Fantastic Poor. Brett says, great interview, Shag. Matt Wadner is not afraid of a microphone for sure. Both guests were very forthcoming and really seemed into the conversation. Great work. Well, thank you, Brett. I wish I could take the credit for it. Matt and John just made it easy. Those guys are amazing. Then we heard from Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog, Comic Box Commentary, and the Legion of Super Bloggers. Dr. Ange says, great interview. What I loved was how Crystal clearly remembered the details about the mini so vividly. This clearly was a passion project and not a paycheck project for these creators. How cool to hear them talk about this little-known, seldomly talked-about miniseries so vividly. Loved this miniseries. Ah, totally agree, Dr. Ange. Then Dave Tomko chimed in and says, great interview, Shag. It was a ton of fun hearing Wagner and Snyder reminisce about their time in the book. From the sound of it, Dr. Midnight was a project that had been developing for quite some time. I'm glad they touched on the influence pulp heroes had on Pieter Cross. I probably got that wrong. Pieter Cross? Matt Wagner taught me how to say this, and I still can't do it. I'm just going to try Pieter. I'm glad they touched on the influence pulp heroes had on Pieter Cross, because that really stood out to me during my reread. I also came away appreciating just how unique all the word balloons were throughout the series. Then we're from Jose A. Rivera again, who says, love this one. Matt and John seem like great guys, so this interview felt like talking to good friends. Kudos to you, Shag, for bringing the enthusiasm and love for the series to the creators. I'm also a sucker for hearing creative teams talk about how they approach a story. As someone who dabbles in writing, it's great to see different methods. Once they mentioned they viewed this almost as a pulp-like character, I suddenly got very excited to reread this miniseries through that lens. And you know how much I adore those pulp characters, so it'll be fun to go back and see all the Doc Savage and Shadow influences. Finally, I don't know why, but I've always dug the full face mask version for Pieter. Between the image of that and the JSA Secret Files and some of the art in the gallery for this episode, I think it looks good. It's a shame that it never stuck around. But then again, with the emphasis on him being a doctor, it's got to be more comforting to talk to a patient or a person in need with half your face exposed rather than the full face mask that's a little too imposing for someone you're trying to help. No, that's a good point, Jose. And I do really like the full face mask as well. But yeah, if you're going to be showing your human side, yeah, that makes more sense, doesn't it? Then we're from Brett Miller, who says, honestly, I thought this Dr. Midnight was named after Piet Retief, who was a famous Dutch settler in South Africa around the time of the First Boer War. He was ambushed by Zulus. I'm saying all these words wrong. Then Brett goes on to say, the reason I thought so is because his story is chronicled in an Alan Quatermain story, Marie. I knew Wagner was an avid reader. All right, Brett. Well, glad we can answer some questions for you there. Heard from Lizanne Oswald again and says, was awesome to hear these two comic creators talk about their experiences and the inspirations that got them to create comics, but also hearing about their run on Dr. Midnight. Enjoyed seeing Dr. Midnight return to the fold in the JSA and watching the team build. Also, learning that Matt Wagner is a great chef is cool. Yeah, Liz, I loved that. I did not expect to learn about Matt Wagner being a chef, but that was really interesting. Then we're from David Ace Gutierrez, owner and operator of the Katana Banana Fruit Stand. David says, fantastic interview, my friend. And finally, that's how they pronounce Pieter. See, I probably said it wrong again, David. Then we're from Jason R. Lady, author of the young adult humorous fantasy adventure novels, Monster Problems, Super Problems, Time Problems, and the Pure Shore Club. And by the way, he was the guest on my most recent episode of Once Upon a Geek talking about X-Men. Jason says, wow, Matt and John were great interviewees. Their love for what they do truly shines through. I remember getting the trade of this series at the library when I went JSA crazy in the early 2000s, and I remember really liking it. I read it on my lunch break at work, and I still remember a coworker borrowing it, and even though she wasn't a comic book person, she really enjoyed it too. I need to reread it. Yeah, Jason, it's great to revisit it. You definitely should. Then we're from Tim Price from the Outcasters Under Siege and Avengers podcast. He says, I'd honestly not read this many before, so this was a kick in the butt I needed. Shocking no one is that I liked it a lot, but everyone here already knows it's good, so I'll leave it at that. And likewise, this conversation with Matt and John was a delight. Congrats on it, Shag. Well, thanks, Tim. Then Nate the Great chimed in and says, Shag, good job on the interview. I seriously thought I was one of the few people to remember this miniseries, although I probably didn't realize the James Bond influence. Also, I kind of wish he would have asked Wagner about his Demon miniseries, too. You know, Nate, honestly, there's probably 100 things I wanted to ask Matt Wagner about, but I tried to really keep it focused on, Dr. Midnight. So, yes, there certainly were other things running through my head, other materials that both of them had worked on, honestly, but I tried to keep it focused. So there you go. Then Chris Franklin chimes in again and says, great episode, Shag. Mr. Wagner and Snyder were wonderful guests, and I think I could listen to them talk about anything, let alone Dr. Midnight. I'm ashamed to admit that I've never read this series. I somehow didn't even know it existed. It, even though I was always up for the JSA and was regularly buying a lot of DC at the time of publication. I've never ran into it in the wild either. When Panther showed up in the JSA title, this was my first indication the series had happened. I need to remedy that ASAP. I just noticed it's on the DC Universe app. Huzzah! Yeah, Chris, absolutely. Jump on the app. I hope you enjoy it, buddy. Then our last comment comes from Rob Kelly from the Firewater Podcast Network. He has shows such as Fade Out and Mashcast, and he is my partner on the Who's Who podcast. Rob says, great interview, Shag. The warmth and artistic respect Matt and John have for one another is obvious. I was intrigued by Matt mentioning the classics illustrated were available at the supermarket checkout when he was a kid. What a neat idea, and a great way to get kids start engaging with classic literature. I wonder when that stopped. Rob, I'll chime in for a second here. Now, obviously, we're talking about the classic illustrated comic books, right? But when I was a kid, so that's what, the 70s and 80s, or early 80s, I should say, our grocery store also had classic illustrated, but they weren't the comic book versions. They were the, kind of like the little big books. You know, they were the short little block of fat books, you know, several hundred pages or whatever. And it would be, you know, probably 5 pages of words to 1 page of pictures, or sometimes it was a picture on every page. So I remember begging my mom to buy those little classics illustrated at the grocery store. I had a massive collection of them growing up. So I had, while I hadn't read the originals, I at least was familiar with the many, many classics. So I know into the 80s, they were selling them in grocery stores. Again, not the comic book versions, but the little small book, illustrated book versions. Okay, then Rob says, I also took note of John K. Snyder's mention of working on Strathmore paper. I remember buying a lot of that at my art school days, and boy, howdy, was it pricey. But as he mentioned, it was durable and you could do a lot with it. All right. Well, thanks for the endorsement, Rob. All right, now this is the part of the show where I thank everyone who shared JSA Presents on their social media timelines. This is Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, Twitter, or X, and Threads. It is a very long list of names, I know that, but these folks showed their support and promoted the show, so it's important to me that we recognize these individuals. And this time out, we've got over 115 people who helped promote the last 2 episodes of the show. So, and honestly, actually, it's probably more, because Facebook and Instagram, they've actually changed the way they do things now, and they're a royal pain for this. Like, I can't see who reshares there anymore. I have to collect the information just from my notifications, and that could be pretty hit or miss. So I did my best, folks. So you could be on this list next month. It's very easy by sharing or retweeting or whatever it's called on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, X or Twitter, or Threads. So my thanks go out to, well, let's see, these first 2 people, somebody named Matt Wagner and John K. Schneider III, both shared it on social media. So thanks to those guys. And then thank you to the rest of you folks. So thanks to Al the Comics Guy, Alan Williams, Alan Boyce Jr., Andrew R., the Redheaded Fanboy, Anthony Cardno, Anthony P., Barry Reese's Infinity Ink Tumblr, Benjamin Hall, Between the Pages Blog, Bill Beer and his The Batpod account, Billy Hines, Billy D. and his accounts A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, and Magazines and Monsters, Brad Dade, Bradford Tree, Brandon Gonzalez, Brett Young, Brian Schufo, Charlton Hero, Charlton 66, Chelsea Daniel, Chloropsia Comics, Chris Franklin, Clinton Robinson and his Fan Films Friday podcast account, Codex Omniversa, Comic Foil, Copra Press Club, Craig McD, D. Kennedy at Detective 38, Damien Maffie, Dan Dougherty, Dave Tomko and his New Earth 2 account, Dave's Comics Heroes blog, David Ace Gutierrez, David Gallagher, Dave Steele and his The Earth 2 podcast account, Derek Crabb, Dr. Ange, Dr. Chris Lewis, Dr. Pop Culture USA, Extremely Uncanny, Fantastic Comic Fan, Gentleman Joey, Gus Casal, Henry Bernstein, J. David Weider, James Perrin, Jan Arah, Jimmy Cummings, Joey Hoffman, John Stibe, Joseph Dredd, J.P. Roca, Justin Steiner, Keen Comics, Keith G. Baker, Kevin Wetter, Lawrence Woods, Lito Sandoval, Lizanne Oswald, L.L.L. Ree, Louis Lou Louis Alzamora, Luciano Viroletti, M.A. Solko, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matt Sirois, Matthew Barton, Max Romero, Michael Bailey in his Bailey Planet account, Mike Jameson in his Pop Culture Basement and Sleazebag Cinema accounts, Mike Thomas, Mo Walker, Nuno Duarte, Orange Chevelle, Otaku Mike, Paul Kean, Sean Ross, Prairie Justice to Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast, Qtari Ninja Warrior, Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Al Sedano and his Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, and That Giffen Show, Richard Field, Rob Kelly, Robert Junker, Rolled Spine Podcast, Ryan Daly and his Batman Nightcast account, Sam Lowe, Scott Taylor, Scott X, Sean Ross and his Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast account, Silverman on Security, S. Matthew Stolte, Stephen E. Shend, Stop, Let's Team Up, Studebaker Jenkins, The Lantern Cast, The Only American Captain Britain Fan, The Telltale Mind, Tim Price and his Outcasters Under Siege, an Avengers podcast account, Tim Rowe, Tony Goins, Venkman, Willie Yarbrough and his Black Vulcan 69 account, and Zek Cap Boots. Whew, oh my goodness. That was not easy. So, seriously, folks, thank you so much for your support of the JSA in the 90s podcast. Your feedback is such a critical part of the show, and the community of JSA fans that we have built together is absolutely the best. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone or lost them through that Facebook and Instagram resharing issue, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Dave Tomko. I mean, I can't imagine it's possibly the fault of Matt Wagner or John K. Schneider III, so yeah, let's blame Dave. I do try to do my best to find all those social media comments, but sometimes they do slip through my internet finger, so if so, I apologize. Just let me know. Drop me a note, and I'll be sure to catch you on the next set of feedback. So please keep those cards and letters coming, folks. You can visit our website at fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA. That is the best place to leave your comments. You can leave them on the show post there, and your fellow JSA fans can communicate with you, and you can have some conversations, which is great. It also guarantees you'll get read on the show. And you can also find us on, again, social media platforms as JSA Presents, and you can email us at justicesocietypresents@gmail.com. Thank you again, everyone, for such an amazing collection of feedback. You guys, I adore all of you. Now, I am going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll connect with this episode's guest, Dave Weider, and we'll see how he managed with the mess left behind by Andromeda.
Transmitter device activated. Coordinates set for Earth 2.
In 1961, in the pages of issue 123 of The Flash, Barry Allen, the Silver Age Flash of Earth 1, travelled to another dimension, met Jay Garrick, the Golden Age Flash of Earth 2, and the DC Multiverse as we know it was born.
And in 1985, after many years of cross-dimensional adventures, DC Comics published the cataclysmic Crisis on Infinite Earths, and the DC Multiverse was gone.
But did you know that Barry Allen's Flash was not the first hero to meet a version of himself from another dimension?
Did you know that Jay Garrick wasn't even the first Golden Age character to return in the Silver Age of comics?
The scope of the pre-crisis DC multiverse reaches far beyond Earth 1 and Earth 2.
And the legacy of DC's Golden Age characters is a lot wider than the heroes you know, like Flash, Green Lantern, Sandman and Starman.
On the Earth 2 podcast, we navigate the pre-crisis DC Comics multiverse of universes and other dimensions.
And we celebrate and explore the legacy of DC's Golden Age characters, including the legendary Justice Society of America, and a lot more besides.
So join me, Peter Watson.
And me, David Steele, and our occasional guests of friends, family and fellow podcasters.
For weekly dramatic readings and analysis of the pre-crisis DC Comics multiverse and the legacy of their Golden Age characters through the Silver and Bronze Ages of comics.
On
the Earth 2 podcast.
Transmatter Cube activated. Return coordinates set for Earth Prime.
Hello there. Come on in and welcome to the Fantastic Four. I am your host, Brett Young, and this is the podcast serving up comics, cocktails, and conversation for your listening pleasure. Every episode, I'll welcome a guest to the Fantastic Lounge to explore one of their favorite comic book characters and cover a classic story in which they're featured. And what pairs better with great literature than a delicious drink? Based on my guest's ingredient of choice, we'll mix up a cocktail or mocktail to enjoy in the Fantastic Lounge while we talk comics, mixology, history, and whatever else comes to mind. So join me every month for the Fantastic Four, open for business by the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Okay, folks, we're back from break, and yes, we've got Dave back with us. First, Dave, my thanks for you coming back and appearing on this episode. It is always a joy to podcast with you, sir. I'm always thankful. So why don't you tell the listeners where they can find more of you on the internets?
Well, there's a site called Only... Oh, wait. I'm on a show called The Bat Pod. I'm still in my Batman phase. Bill Beer and I, we will review old Batman comics, and he has actually gotten me to read a current Batman comic, the current run by Matt Fraction. I don't know what the over-under is on what point I'm going to rage quit, but I will say it's going really well.
All right.
Other than that, there's stuff that's coming down the pike that I'm not ready to announce yet.
Well, awesome. And folks, there's, of course, lots of back episodes of the Bat Pod to listen to. And you can find Dave appearing on all kinds of different shows over the years. He is a phenomenal host. He's a phenomenal guest and a hell of a great guy.
Well, I appreciate that. I don't know if it's true, but I appreciate you saying that. The check is in the mail. But I do appreciate you having me here. This is my audio comfort food, as I said, because you cover stuff that was, you know, around when I was a teenager. So slightly younger than you, but not by a lot.
I got to admit, every time you've ever posted that comment about it being audio comfort food, it just makes me so happy. It makes me think of like a nice big bowl of mac and cheese, and brings me joy.
Yeah, exactly. And I make a great mac and cheese, by the way.
Ooh.
Smoked Gouda is my secret.
Oh, goodness gracious. Oh, my gosh. I may have to make a special trip to Missouri just for that, folks.
Yep.
Well, thank you again, Dave. And, folks, that is going to do it. Come back next episode when we present a spotlight episode on a specific JSA character, or in this case, a JSA-adjacent character. And I'll be joined by a fantastic guest to help me cover the issue. Who will it be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Dave.
And we're asking you to join the fight.
For justice.